Chapter 10. Bishop. It might have been raining even harder after the away team arrived at the facility's garbage dump once Lieutenant Collins announced her discovery. Large, heavy droplets consistent with a storm gaining momentum pounded the surface of everything when they emerged into the open, splattering upon contact. Visible sheets of water swept across the prison, like airborne waves. Overhead, the pale sky disappeared behind thick clouds, and it didn't feel like the morning, but late afternoon, almost twilight. Alex looked up with a troubled expression after analyzing the readings of the brewing storm. High-energy particles in the atmosphere created an unfortunate mix she did not like, particularly its effect on their communications. Suddenly, Alex had a good idea why Fiorina avoided colonization. Tapping the comm badge on her uniform, she attempted to contact the Sulaco.
Julia, come in.
Nothing but a near-incoherent cackling greeted her.
Julia.
Alex raised her eyes to meet Ezra's.
Come in.
Once again, another burst of static erupted before dissipating into nothingness. Ezra tried to do the same to satisfy himself it wasn't just Alex's comm badge malfunctioning. However, like Alex, he had no success in reaching Julia.
Why can't we contact the ship?
It's nothing serious.
Alex answered the captain to defuse the situation before it escalated into concern.
The atmospheric properties that make transport impossible are slightly more pronounced because of the present weather patterns. I would say the storms are part of it. Our communications blackout will last as long as the storms. Once it clears, it should return to normal levels again.
What if there is an emergency?
Ezra was not about to be deterred by the simple explanation because even if it was a natural phenomenon, they were still cut off from the Sulaco and the runabout until the storm ended.
We can always use the radio on the dropship,
Wynn suggested.
That would only be effective if Julia is listening in on the radio. She would expect us to contact her via our comm badges.
The security chief returned, pressing the issue. Chris let out a deep breath, not about to turn back when the EEV was only a short distance away.
Look, the situation is far from dangerous. Communications are out, but it's only temporary, yes?
He glanced at Alex for confirmation.
Yes, sir. I estimate we should have communications online once the storm passes.
We do not know how long that could be. In the meantime, we could run into danger.
Ezra countered quickly.
If that happens,
Chris bristled, not liking the adversarial stance Ezra was taking with him.
Then we will abort the mission and return to the Sulaco. However,
his voice filled with open menace as he glared at the security chief.
For the moment, there is no reason we cannot continue our investigations. Is there?
No, sir.
Ezra muttered unhappily, and the tension between the senior staff was palpable until they reached the EEV.
It's in pretty awful shape,
Wynn stated, trying to change the subject and soothe the escalating tempers between his captain and the security chief. The helmsman could tell Ezra was fast reaching a point where he would refuse to back down, protocol or not. Wynn knew it, and Alex knew it too. When that happened, Ezra would come up against the brick wall of Chris Larrabee's worst, and no one wanted to see that in all its horrific glory. However, one thing came out of this. Wynn secretly decided it was time he and his best friend had the conversation he had been putting off because Chris was his captain. Even Wynn could not ignore the erratic way Chris was behaving. Under normal circumstances, everything Ezra pointed out was reasonable, not some obstacle to circumvent Chris getting his way. Decomposition and weather laid waste to the biological refuse, so plastics, metal, and other miscellaneous items made up the bulk of the remaining rubbish. The EEV suffered the same climatic wear, with rust spreading across the craft's surface until its original paintwork and finish were no longer visible. The enormous gaping hole in the hull told the away team about its landing on Fiorina. Large dents and torn metal across the titanium hull showed a catastrophic crash, and it was a miracle if any of its passengers survived the landing.
It's been sitting out in the open for the last 400 years.
Alex braved the rain and strode into the middle of the junk pile.
In this climate, it's a miracle it isn't a rusted out piece of scrap.
I beg to differ.
Ezra grumbled as he followed the science officer, not about to allow her to enter the transport alone. Chris bristled in annoyance that, once again, his overprotective officers went ahead of him. Collins remained outside in the rain, keeping a close watch on the surrounding area while the senior staff made a close inspection of the dilapidated transport.
This was one hell of a crash,
Wynn observed as they stepped inside the small space. The metallic stench of rust confronted them straight away. While the inside of the craft was mostly dry, the tear in the hull allowed rust to penetrate deeply into the structure. Evidence of the crash was everywhere, from the wiring draped loosely over their heads to the shattered cryo tubes and torn superstructure. A support beam had crushed one tube, and the brown discoloration on the broken glass around it could only be one thing: blood.
Is that what I think it is?
Ezra asked as they stared at the faded residue of dried blood against the glass so stained nothing could remove it. When it was fresh, it must have splattered against the glass with such force it would have killed whoever was occupying the cryo tube.
Yes,
Alex confirmed with her tricorder, her expression dark as she tried to think of how to relay her readings. Before leaving the Sulaco, she downloaded all the personnel records into the tricorder in case they needed to refer to it while they were on Fiorina 361. It was nothing more than a bit of meticulous foolishness that Alex had never considered needing until now.
What is it?
Chris caught the look in her eyes.
I'm sorry, Captain. The DNA residue of the blood in this cryotube matches one of the Colonial Marines.
Chris sucked in his breath. There was no need for her to explain. The only passenger of the EEV who was a Colonial Marine was Hicks. Turning away from her, Chris stared at the cryotube as everyone felt silent, trying to imagine what he was thinking. The captain of the Maverick felt a deep sense of loss and futility for his ancestor, who he had never given more than a second thought before they had encountered the Sulaco. After everything he endured on Acheron, Chris found it incredibly unfair that Hicks would meet his end in an accident like this. Hicks fought aliens and escaped a thermonuclear explosion, only to be crushed to death when their EEV crashed. At least Hicks never knew what hit him. He would have gone to sleep in his cryo tube, expecting to get home, unaware he would never wake up again. It was a far more merciful end to his being awake when the end came. Chris supposed that was something.
It would have been painless.
Alex quickly spoke up, feeling the need to say it.
He was probably still in hypersleep when they crashed.
I know,
Chris whispered.
I had hoped he made it.
It was always going to be an impossible hope regarding what they already knew about Fiorina, with only one prisoner having left here alive. There had been no mention of any other survivors, thus whatever took place here, it had not only taken Hicks but everyone who reached Fury 361 alive on the EEV, including Ripley.
I'm sorry, Chris,
Wynn responded while Ezra moved deeper into the vehicle, hoping no one else met their end as violently as Chris's ancestor.
It's okay.
Chris let out a deep sigh.
I never knew him to mourn him.
Oh, Alex.
Ezra beckoned the science officer.
I think I may have found what you were looking for.
The security officer was at the far end of the EEV, standing before what appeared to be the only undamaged console panel in the entire craft. From where he was, Chris could not see what Ezra was studying so closely and quickly advanced next to the security officer for a better look.
Hell,
Wynn whispered as they came upon the sight of what looked like the upper torso of a human body. The head, neck, and shoulder remained intact. However, heat, most likely from the crash, distorted the rubberized skin, creating an ugly swelling around one eye. The effect was quite gruesome. Undoubtedly, this was the fabled synthetic Alex was so eager to find.
I take it that is one of your synthetics?
Ezra ventured a guess as Alex approached the thing. She nodded mutely as her shock slipped away, and the scientist in her moved to examine the find she was speaking of so enthusiastically to Julia earlier on. She was probably the first person in 400 years to cast her eyes on an android of the 21st century to fully understand its significance.
He has to be the synthetic from the Sulaco.
Looks like he didn't survive the crash any better than Hicks.
Chris stared at this construct, who probably knew Corporal Dwayne Hicks in person. Despite its ruined state, one had to marvel at the intricacy of the construction. When it was in its prime, Chris did not doubt this android could blend thoroughly into human society without notice. The Optimum Movement, who had called such constructs abominations, believed it enough to wipe their existence from the records.
Wait a minute.
Alex's eyes narrowed, seeing wires and plugs connecting the EEV systems to the ruined android's exposed innards. The attachments were in place to resurrect him, even in this damaged state. While the EEV was drained of power by now, the links were all in place and might still function.
Someone tried to power him up.
She glanced over her shoulder at the captain.
I think they tried to reactivate him. They linked his connections to the main power grid and then deactivated him later.
She continued to scan the crude interface and noted that despite the age of the wires and conduits, they appeared to be operable.
400 years ago. It couldn't possibly still work after all this time, could it?
Wynn stared at the android. There was so much it could tell them. This remarkable piece of damaged technology could answer every question the away team had about the Sulaco's mission.
Let's find out,
Alex replied, forgetting all about the android's condition, and went to work reanimating it. With expert knowledge, Alex quickly disconnected the wires attaching the android to the EEV's mainframe and transplanted them to her tricorder. The lithium polymer battery inside the device was more than capable of bringing this 21st century relic to life.
What are you doing?
Chris asked, even though he had a good idea of what she was attempting to do.
I'm seeing if I can bring him back.
Alex, is that the wisest course of action at this point?
Ezra questioned, uncertain if this was wise.
You wanted answers, Ezra.
Chris quickly cut in to keep Ezra from interrupting the science officer's work.
This is an eyewitness to what happened to the Sulaco and, possibly, what happened here. If we are going to sort this out, we need to access what he knows.
Ezra could not fault that part of the captain's reasoning and supposed a story told by an android bound to obey humans was trustworthy intelligence. A sudden burst of electricity silenced any response he was about to make. The charge scented the air with noxious odors as energy flowed through the old wires, burning out some and rerouting others. When the fingers attached to the android's good arm began twitching spasmodically, Ezra knew Alex had succeeded. The android twitched as energy flowed through what remained of his senses. He tilted his head back as a gush of white ooze sputtered out his mouth. It made him cough as if he were choking, prompting the humans to retreat to avoid the biomechanical spray. The android did not notice them at first and needed a few seconds to recover before he opened his eyes. The swollen eye was milky white, making the android look even more grotesque than before as he slowly took stock of his surroundings.
Jesus,
Chris whispered. Despite the damage to his systems, the android's hearing still functioned well. He reacted to Chris's voice by shifting his gaze toward the captain. Visible surprise flowed through his misshapen features as he cocked his head slightly and stared at Chris. There was recognition in his eyes but also confusion.
Hicks,
the raspy voice, watered with fluid, asked after a momentary pause. It took Chris a second to realize the android thought him to be his dead ancestor. After seeing the picture of Hicks in the Sulaco's records, Chris couldn't blame him for that. The resemblance between them had been uncanny. Except for their age differences, Chris Larrabee and Dwayne Hicks might have been twins.
No.
Chris shook his head.
You look like him, but...
The android's eyes narrowed as he tried to explain himself.
You're older.
My name is Chris Larrabee. Hicks was an ancestor.
Chris saw no reason to keep the truth from the android, who was hardly in a position to do anything.
The resemblance is striking.
The android observed. His voice was soft, reminding those present a little of Josiah's with its tones of sympathetic tenderness.
I don't recognize the uniform. Military?
United Federation of Planets. You're 400 years from where you started out.
The android paused for a moment, absorbing this information. Chris would have sworn he saw sadness if he believed it was possible for a machine to feel. Then again, Jean-Luc Picard thought his second officer Commander Data was quite capable of emotion.
Ripley is dead.
Yes.
Chris nodded because, however she met her end, it was still four centuries in the past.
So she never made it off Fury?
Did she survive the crash? By the looks of it, it was pretty bad.
She survived.
The android answered and studied Wynn for a moment.
You're not human.
No.
Wynn said with a little smile.
I'm Vulcan.
A planet that revolves around Eridani,
Alex explained.
Vulcans were the first aliens to make contact with Earth.
There is so much missing.
His gaze shifted away.
I must be a relic.
Actually,
Ezra corrected.
You appear to be a find. We have not seen the likes of you in almost 400 years. You will be quite the celebrity when you return to Earth.
It's still there.
The android asked quietly, with a trace of hope in his voice.
Do you know what happened to Ripley?
Chris asked, interrupting the android's musings.
You said she made it down here.
Yes. Ripley was the only one who lived. The others died in the crash.
He paused a moment as he looked at Chris.
Hicks died in his cryotube. A support beam impaled him in the chest. He never regained consciousness.
I guessed. What about the little girl?
She drowned in her tube.
The android responded, holding back nothing.
The EEV crashed into the sea. Newt's cryotube filled up with water. By the time the rescue people found her, it was too late. I doubt she woke up either.
The android closed its eyes, feeling the sorrow of lost friends. He thought about little Newt, stranded on Acheron for all that time, avoiding the aliens to be rescued, only to die on the way home in a crash. Sometimes, this thing the humans called fate could be callously indifferent.
I'm sorry.
Alex replied, convinced the grief she saw in its disfigured features was real.
Ripley never left here alive, she died here.
There was an alien with us. It attempted to get to us in stasis when the Sulaco's security systems kicked in, and a protection grid killed it. The acid the spore uses for blood caused an electrical fire, which was why the capsules were moved to the EEV. Unfortunately, it was not alone. There was another spore on the ship, and it came down with us all the way. The last time I talked with Ripley, I think she suspected someone here of being infected.
How did it get on the Sulaco in the first place?
Ezra inquired.
If I was not mistaken, you left the colony on Acheron shortly before a thermonuclear explosion.
Yes. The aliens captured Newt and took her to the Hive. Ripley went in after her and discovered the alien queen, the egg layer. The morphology of these creatures is very similar to bees, with a single female ruling the entire hive. Ripley retrieved Newt and somehow caused enough damage for the queen to escape her egg sac. Unfortunately, she clung to the dropship when we returned to the Sulaco. She left me in this state, but Ripley got her off the ship by throwing her into the airlock.
That explains the acid burns.
Chris glanced at Ezra.
But not how there could be eggs on board.
Ezra turned back to the android.
Are you saying in the short time the queen was on board the Sulaco, she laid more of her progeny?
Their ability to breed is prolific.
Wonderful. Well, I believe I understand why this place was so quickly abandoned and why only one prisoner was left alive.
Yeah, one of those aliens must have got loose.
Ripley said there was something very unusual about this alien. She had not quite seen one like it before.
Unfortunately, we'll never really know.
Perhaps you ought to access the EEV systems. It was the only sophisticated piece of equipment here and far more efficient than anything else they had in the prison facility. If you're after facts, that might be the place to start.
Thank you.
Chris said gratefully.
You got a name?
He asked the android, wanting to know after it had been so helpful.
Bishop. They used to call me Bishop.
When Julia could not contact the captain, she quickly decided she had only one alternative left. She had to go to Fiorina herself. Julia did not know how long it took for the alien to mature, but she wasn't waiting to find out. Besides, Julia suspected the alien would come looking for her if she did not get off this ship soon. Logic dictated the creature could not grow enough to be a threat in the space of a few hours, so she made a few more attempts to reach the away team on Fury with little success. Returning to the runabout, Julia faced the bloody remains of Lieutenant Atwater. For a second, Julia considered abandoning the idea of going to Fiorina to avoid being inside the craft. Then she remembered if it were lying there instead of Atwater, he wouldn't be treating her remains with such revulsion. Taking a deep breath, Julia cleaned up Atwater's bloody remains before replicating a body bag to store his corpse for the duration. After she tended to Lieutenant Atwater, Julia ran a diagnostic of the craft following the alien's birth and the security officer's violent death. There appeared to be no damage even though she was sure the stench of fresh blood was still in the air despite the filtration system. Sensors on the runabout showed an atmospheric disturbance occurring on Fiorina, which accounted for the communication blackout. However, Julia worried about her friends, especially Ezra, after what she had seen. This hastened her determination to leave the Sulaco. When it was time to depart, Julia entered the cockpit and began powering up the required systems for launch. The floor beneath her began humming reassuringly as the engines ignited and light illuminated the previously darkened panels and console screens. Something dark slithered past the corner of her eye at the bow of the runabout. Through the glass of the cockpit window, it curled upright and was no longer 1 foot tall. The creature before her was almost man-sized, if not a little taller. For a second, she could only gape in horror as it lifted its smooth curved head, glistening with slimy fluid, seeming as if it was staring even though it had no eyes. The teeth bared were razor-sharp, and ooze glinted off the inch-long fangs, pooling on the glass. She couldn't hear its hiss through the window, but Julia could imagine it. For a moment, neither human nor alien reacted as both regarded each other as prey and predator. There was an instant of clarity when Julia knew it was going to attack. In space, the deflectors ensured very little could penetrate the screen of glass making up the cockpit window. However, the shields were not up, and as the alien snarled and prepared to lunge, Julia realized she could not shoot it without destroying the window. It would make it impossible for her to launch the runabout. Did the alien also know this? The possibility terrified her. It smashed into the window, startling Julia out of her chair. Glass shattered, creating a spider web pattern across the screen as the alien attempted to push through the crack. Julia grabbed her phaser, but the creature maneuvered its spindly tail through the fissure to reach her. Like a whip, it swooshed through the air and struck her hand above the wrist. Julia screamed as she felt bones snap, and her hand released the phaser. It skittered out of reach somewhere. She had no time to suffer her pain because the alien was forcing its bulk through the widening crack of the cockpit window. If it got inside, she was dead or worse, cocooned. Julia jumped to her feet and bolted for the runabout's hatch. Slamming her uninjured fist against the door panel, the creature turned to her sharply as the door started sliding open. It discontinued the effort to enter the runabout, intending to intercept her at the door. More glass broke as the alien pulled itself free. Escaping the runabout, she ran harder and faster than she had ever done. The open doors of the power loader bay offered an escape, and Julia raced towards it. Panic gripped Julia, hearing its chitin-like exoskeleton clacking against the steel deck as it chased after her. Her palm slammed down on the control panel of the massive door a split second before she went through. Only the low whine of the hydraulics bringing the door down dared Julia to turn around. Beyond it, the alien uttered another indignant screech, realizing she was about to escape. As it closed in, Julia found her back to the wall, gaping in terror at the alien's attempt to reach her through the narrowing gap of the door. Before it could close completely, the xenomorph snarled furiously at having to withdraw or risk losing its entire arm. Its retreat was a temporary reprieve because no sooner than the door clanged shut, the alien threw itself against the steel. For a few seconds, frenzied pounding echoed through the bay as it tried to break through. Eventually it gave up, leaving her in silence. Julia did not give herself the luxury of believing the xenomorph had retreated. It was just searching for another way in. Willing her legs to move, Julia knew she had little time to waste. The alien would be coming. At the end of the loader bay was a door to the rest of the Sulaco. The engineer hurried to it, even though her legs still felt rubbery, thinking only one thing. Julia hated it when Ezra was right. Chapter 11. Hive. Upon first sight, it was easy to say that neither Ensign Angel nor Christie had ever seen anything like it. The structure stood at the edge of the prison facility, unseen from the air because it blended so well with the gray, dour background of the prison and mining complex. It did not take them long to conclude this curious construct that stood apart from the prison had nothing to do with the Weyland-Yutani Corporation. The dome was a stark contrast to the block-shaped buildings of sharp angles running against the skyline. For a moment, its bizarre construction tempted the duo to contact the senior officers to report their find. They abandoned this sensible course because they were still uncertain about what they were seeing. Fear of looking foolish before their superior officers led them to the decision to investigate further. Christie suggested they should inspect the structure before reporting to the chief. At first glance, the structure didn't seem very far from the edge of the facility. However, once they started across the complex, the gap widened, and they realized not only did they misjudge the distance of the object but also its size. Even more perplexing, it wasn't immediately clear what was used to construct the dome. Its architecture was as alien as any they had previously encountered and strangely organic. The dome was not composed of any conventional building material. Nearing it, the two junior officers realized why. Everything from tables and chairs, kitchen utensils, and broken machinery was being forced into place and held together with a thick epoxy-like resin. Both officers gaped at the wall that resembled a piece of abstract artwork from a tortured sculptor's mind. There were no apparent openings, nothing that allowed light inside, and for reasons neither could understand, the thought sent slivers of uneasiness through both Christie and Angel.
"We should report this."
Angel stared at it through the veil of teeming rain. Despite being soaked to the skin, she didn't feel the cold because of the humidity. While initially eager to explore this strange discovery, now they were near it, Angel suspected they were dealing with something entirely out of their depth. For once, she was grateful to defer to the judgment of senior officers.
"I think you're right. You contact Lieutenant Collins, and I'll take a closer look at this thing." There has to be a way inside.
If you do, don't go in,
she warned as he drew away from her.
At least not until you let me know. You're not doing this alone.
Yes, Mom.
Very funny.
Angel grumbled and gave him a dismissive wave before tapping her comm badge.
Lieutenant Collins.
She spoke over the hiss of rainfall. Lieutenant Collins, who was presently standing guard outside the EEV, responded immediately.
Collins here. What's up, Angel?
We've found something, sir.
What exactly have you found?
Collins tensed up immediately. Lieutenant Sue Collins was known for her happy-go-lucky and relaxed manner. She worked closely with Lieutenant Katovic but was more approachable than the assistant security chief. Most of the time, Collins acted as the first port of call when security team members had concerns they wanted to run up the chain of command. Often these issues didn't require the intervention of the assistant security chief or the chief himself. As a result, Collins soon developed the reputation of being a den mother to the younger officers.
It's a crudely built dome that doesn't look like part of the prison facility. Its construction is strange.
How so?
Well, they made it using materials from the facility. I'm talking about everyday stuff, like furniture, chairs, and utensils. It reminds me of those sculptures you make in arts and crafts. There aren't any windows, and Christy is investigating the grounds looking for a way in.
A dozen kinds of alarm bells rang in Colin's ears.
Hold position. Contact Christy and tell him not to proceed until you receive further instructions. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Angel noted the tension in Collins's voice and sensed danger. Eyeing the dome again, something about it made her skin crawl. If Collins shared her concerns, it was for good reason.
Angel out.
Angel sought Christy, skirting the dome's edges and becoming increasingly anxious about not spotting him. Had he found a way in? Scanning the weird walls, she searched for any sign of him before her gaze rested on what looked like a dark gash on one section of its base. Angel closed in, observing it as little more than a crack of space between objects fused in its strange configuration, but was large enough for entry. Tapping her comm badge, she tried to raise Christy again.
Christy, where the hell are you?
Christy did not answer, raising Angel's apprehension even more. After a few seconds of debate, Angel approached the opening. If Christy was in there, he shouldn't be alone. Despite her better judgment, Angel slipped into the narrow, ragged fissure. She realized how much she missed the rain and daylight left behind when she was inside, bathed in near-total darkness. Fumbling for her belt, she grasped the small torch hanging with the rest of the equipment issued for an away team mission. Angel's heart pounded with panic the longer she remained in the darkness, not even registering the rank odor wafting through the place. Light flooded the chamber, revealing a maze of tunnels, all built from the peculiar alien resin. Thick, ropey tendrils covered the walls, giving Angel the sense of being trapped in something alive. The smell finally assaulted her and made her gag. The scent was familiar, even though she could not place it at the moment.
Christy! Are you in here?
There was no answer as Angel's voice echoed through the twisting, winding paths of the maze. A terrible foreboding of something awful happening to Christy gripped her. Fear for his life kept her feet moving instead of retreating. She continued deeper, breathing in more of that terrible stench. The inside of the dome felt like a hothouse for plants, turning her skin damp with perspiration. There were no signs of movement as she continued her search, calling out for Christy, cursing at him for making her wander through the Stygian darkness alone. Christy was outside. After surveying the base of the dome and finding the same entrance Angel had, Christy chose wisely not to enter and continued on his way, searching for other entrances. While doing this, he discovered his comm badge was malfunctioning when he attempted to contact Angel to tell her what he found. Examining the small communicator, he learned water penetration of the casing caused the malfunction. It was a simple matter to repair but needed to take place somewhere drier. Not wishing to be out of communication with Angel, Christy decided the wisest course of action would be to turn back to rejoin her. Except she wasn't there. With dismay, he realized she might have taken her inability to contact him as a sign of danger and went looking for him. It occurred to him she might have found the entrance to the dome and gone inside. Christy had no intention of allowing her to face anything alone if she had entered the structure because of him. Without hesitation, he made his way to the fissure and found himself enclosed in the same darkness. Christy did not scare easily. He grew up in British Columbia, and while it was one of the most beautiful places on Earth, it was also the most dangerous. Kodiak bears, wolves, and mountain lions roamed freely, endangered no more thanks to conservation efforts. Anyone who could become comfortable living near such creatures did not frighten easily.
Angel!
Christy called out beyond the beam of his torch.
I'm here!
Her cry filled him with profound relief when he heard it a few seconds later. She was some distance away, but not so far he couldn't reach her quickly.
Stay where you are!
He ordered, feeling a surge of protectiveness towards the young, willowy woman, who was brave as she was beautiful. Christy smiled, thinking Angel would probably hit him if she knew he thought of her that way. The chamber Christy found Angel resembled nothing like the ones previously encountered. For starters, loose bones covered the floor. They did not appear to be human but that of small animals, like dogs and cats. A closer examination revealed the sternum of all these creatures had shattered outward, leaving fragments across the tendril-covered floor. Some of the corpses were attached to the walls, held in place by resin. Now he recognized the stench. It was the lingering odor of decomposed flesh. Fighting to avoid gagging, Christy composed himself to reach Angel at last.
Look at this.
Angel pointed to leathery objects standing next to every corpse. Elliptically shaped and no more than a foot high, they were unsealed like the burst pod of a flower. Whatever they contained had long since departed because the interior of the biological canisters was empty.
What the hell is this place?
I don't know, but I think we ought to get out of here.
With that, Christy could not disagree.
I think you're right.
They turned around slowly and retreated the way they had come, or so they believed. The dark and meandering tunnels were so odd and confusing it became hard to tell if they were going the right way. Suddenly, they entered a new chamber and stopped short immediately. They were surrounded by unsealed pods. The chamber was the largest one they had seen yet. Neither of them could tell where it ended. Mesmerized, they surveyed the room, resting on the pulsing life inside the translucent objects, wet with moisture and digits moving through the viscous fluid. Understanding struck Christy with the force of a sledgehammer.
Dawn, we're in an egg chamber.
Of what?
She never got an answer to her question. Christy stood against the irregular shape of what they both assumed to be the strange construction of the wall. Neither expected that something had been waiting for a long time in the shadows. The massive inner jaws that smashed through Christie's cranium moved so fast, he didn't have time to scream. It impaled the back of his skull and exited through his face with such force, his head cracked apart like an egg. Angel staggered backward, screaming as everything that was her friend splattered across her uniform. What killed Christy retracted its jaws and lowered its large crowned head to regard the remaining human. Not even the light of her torch could penetrate the darkness to show Angel how really big it was. Upon retracting its inner jaws past another set of mandibles, it hissed at her with its foot-long teeth and cocked its eyeless head to stare right at her. Something inside Angel snapped. Filled with blind panic, she scrambled to her feet and started running, not looking back. She raced through the dark maze, her torch gripped tightly in her sweating palm, aware something was happening around her. Things were slithering to life in the darkness. Things that she and Christy had awakened from their hibernation, breaking free and moving across the floor with footsteps that were not all human. Those vague, nondescript noises struck icy fear through her heart, and Angel ran so fast the blood started rushing in her ears. Daylight became visible, but Angel did not stop running. A pessimistic who always prepared for the worst, she wasn't about to let her guard down, not that escape was within reach. Just as the thought crossed her mind, something leaped out in front of her. Although smaller than the nightmarish figure that claimed Christie's life, this one was no less lethal. It hissed at her, bearing ferociously sharp teeth at the end of its elongated head. Angel knew the claws it brandished in her direction could tear her apart and reacted instinctively, firing her phaser without hesitation. The beam of energy struck the creature in the chest and flung it backward, its body exploding. Acid sprayed in all directions, eating into the ground as soon as it made contact. Angel paid little attention and continued running, leaping over its remains before escaping through the fissure.
Angel!
Collins was already there with the chief.
I told you not to go in!
Collins barked angrily, noting the blood on the younger woman.
We can't stay! They're coming!
What's coming?
Take it easy, Ensign.
Ezra spoke up, trying to get some sense out of her.
Sir, there's no time!
Angel declared, averting her eyes from him to the fissure.
They're in there! They killed Christy!
The Ensign is right.
Ezra responded, needing to hear nothing more. He knew perfectly well what was inside the dome and had known it ever since he saw this structure. There would be enough time for explanations later, but the ensign's advice was sound judgment for now.
We have to leave here immediately.
What is it, sir?
Collins asked, seeing the fear in his eyes. Ezra glanced at the darkness of the fissure for a second before answering.
History repeating itself.
I'm going to disconnect you for a while, Bishop.
Alex told the android as she prepared to transport him to the Sulaco.
Oh.
Bishop responded quietly, clearly disliking going to sleep again.
It's okay. I'm not leaving you behind. You're coming back with us to the Sulaco and then the Maverick.
The Maverick?
Yes, it's our ship.
Alex responded, sensing the android's anxiety about being disconnected again.
A warship?
No.
She shook her head.
A lot has changed. While we defend the borders of the planets in the Federation, our charter is mostly for exploring new life, to extend cooperation between all member races towards peaceful coexistence.
An admirable goal, very different from my time.
You'll have plenty to catch up on. Now I have to disconnect you, but I promise it won't be for long.
I believe you.
Bishop showing her his trust. His faith in her touched Alex, and she promised herself inwardly whatever happened during this mission, she was not abandoning him.
Alex,
when hurried into the EEV,
we've got trouble.
What sort of trouble?
Ensign Christie is dead. He and Ensign Angel found what Ezra thinks is some kind of nest outside the facility.
How is that possible?
Alex gasped in shock.
There has only been one alien on this planet.
All the drones can produce some eggs if alone.
Bishop spoke up.
It is from this group that they usually create a queen.
An egg layer.
Alex whispered.
Yes.
Bishop nodded, seeing that she understood the ramifications.
But they have abandoned this planet for the last 400 years.
Alex could not wrap her mind around it. Everything they knew implied there would have to be hosts for the aliens to reproduce in large numbers, and, to their knowledge, Fiorina had been devoid of humans for almost four centuries.
There wouldn't have been any viable hosts.
Alex, we can debate this later.
Wynn said shortly, helping her to gather her tools.
Right now, we've got to go.
All right, I'll see you soon.
She assured Bishop before disconnecting the attachments that kept him conscious. The androids remained spasmed at the cessation of power, twitching sharply for a few seconds before he stopped moving.
Is Ensign Angel all right?
Alex asked as she gathered up Bishop's remains.
She's fine but shaken up.
Wynn answered as they left the EEV.
Alex, there are aliens here, and judging from what Angel has told us, there are many of them.
Alex looked at him.
What do you mean, a lot of them?
Her question went unanswered for a moment as they joined the captain, Ezra, Collins, and the distressed ensign. Angel was trying her best not to let her fear overcome her. No simple task after what she had just seen.
We're moving out.
Chris announced as soon as he saw them.
Alex.
Ezra turned to her.
Can you configure the tricorder to detect these creatures? I am detecting no life signs at all.
It's not set up to deal with possible silicon-based creatures.
Alex explained as she took the device from the security chief.
Exactly what did you see, Ensign?
I knew we shouldn't have gone in.
Angel stammered as they hurried towards the dropship.
But I thought Christie was in there, and I didn't want to leave him alone.
It's all right, Ensign.
Chris said soothingly, noting the guilt in her voice.
You didn't want to abandon a comrade. That's admirable.
Thank you, sir.
She swallowed and continued.
It was dark in there, and the whole place was bizarre, like being inside something alive. I should have guessed what it was. Now that I think about it, it looked like an ant hive. I entered quite a way when I heard Christie. We met up in this chamber with all these bones in it.
Human bones?
Chris asked, his stomach hollowing at the thought.
No, sir.
She shook her head.
Small animals, like dogs and cats. Captain, there were a lot of them. On the ground and on the walls.
The walls.
Alex stared at them.
That's the same way the Marines found the colonists on LV-427. They were all suspended along the walls of the atmosphere processor for embryo implantation.
I don't understand how there could be that many cats and dogs on this planet. Where did they come from?
The company.
The company?
Chris shot Ezra a look.
How do you figure that?
Consider this if you may.
Ezra remarked as they moved through the facility as fast as possible, their footsteps making harsh sounds against the cracked linoleum floors.
What if the alien that came down here from the Sulaco laid eggs? There were more than enough prisoners to act as hosts for its progeny. Of course, we assumed they killed the creature when the company shut down the facility. But what would happen if eggs were also present? the company finally had what it wanted, alien specimens in what we could consider a controlled environment. They close the facility and start bringing in dogs and cats, creatures large enough and completely expendable to be used as hosts. Naturally, one of these was a queen, if we can compare these creatures to bees or ants.
You wouldn't be wrong.
Alex concurred with his theory.
Before I disconnected him, Bishop said as much. All alien drones can lay some eggs, one of which can be a queen.
With a queen and a steady influx of animals to act as incubators for the spores, the company had its own colony of aliens.
Ezra concluded.
But why leave them here, sir? After all that, why just abandon them?
That's easy.
Chris responded in complete agreement with Ezra's hypothesis over what happened here at Fiorina 361.
World War III. Outposts were abandoned, recalling scientific personnel back to Earth. I'm sure whoever was in charge here did not want to stay in orbit around Fury, considering what's waiting for them on the surface.
I think I saw her.
Saw what?
Collins looked at Angel.
The Queen. She was huge, Chief. I mean, she wasn't moving or anything, but she was enormous. She didn't even have to move when she killed Christie.
Her voice threatened to break, but Angel maintained her composure.
Not unusual. The Queen is usually larger than the normal drone. The queen and wasp and bee colonies may sting many more times and are often larger, whereas, in termites and ants, she usually needs caring for and is quite helpless.
Okay.
Alex stated as they reached the tarmac where the dropship awaited them.
I've configured this thing so it will register non-carbon-based life forms.
I hope we don't need it.
Wynn hastened his pace to reach the dropship first.
From all accounts, anyone running into these things is going to have a bad day. I say we leave while we can.
Good idea.
Chris agreed. Alex did not answer at first. She was staring at the tricorder, almost frozen.
Captain, I think we better get moving.
Why?
Chris knew why. He just did not know how bad. Ezra came next to her, and when he saw the display, his face drained of color too.
Because I'm reading one big bloody signal.
Chapter 13. Crash Landing. The dropship seemed untouched when it came into view on the landing pad. However, this was no assurance they were safe. According to the tricorders, the aliens were all around them and had a better knowledge of the prison layout than they did. Fury 361 was a maze of shafts, underground access ways, electrical access tunnels, and crawl spaces. All of which the aliens were more than capable of exploiting from what the away team learned of the Acheron disaster. In Chris's opinion, they would be exceedingly lucky if they made it off the planet. What he saw on the tricorder screen justified Alex's startling announcement and Ezra's pallor. The approaching aliens were so many it was difficult to take an accurate count, and judging by their trajectory, they were about to converge upon the potential hosts who unwittingly strayed into their realm. The rain and the wind picked up momentum again, creating even more confusion as window shutters slammed and doors flew open, adding distracting noises to the chaos of their departure. Ezra, Chris, Collins, and Angel kept a watchful eye out for the savage creatures while Wynn and Alex went on ahead. Wynn needed to get to the dropship first to prep the craft for takeoff. Ripley provided them with scant information about the alien's abilities, other than it was a killer, capable of surviving in a vacuum, and had no trouble getting through barricades. Chris hoped this did not include titanium hulls as well.
How close?
Chris demanded once the dropship appeared through the rain.
30 meters.
Ezra answered and saw Angel's eyes widening with panic. After seeing firsthand what the things could do, Ezra did not blame her for her terror. They were moving across the tarmac, making good time, when suddenly, a screech filled the air just as they circled the dropship to reach the main hatch. The alien scrambled over the top of a nearby building with such speed it was nothing more than a dark blur against the gray sky. It was no less terrifying in daylight than in the shadows, and were it alone, they might not have felt as panicked. But the alien wasn't alone, for others followed, and they did not move like isolated killers but with the coordination of pack hunters. The lead xenomorph hissed at its comrades, teeth bared while resin oozed in long rivulets from the 2-inch fangs. Chris understood immediately. It was a signal to attack.
Oh shit.
The creature sprung from the roof of the single-story building like a coiled serpent with fangs bared. Behind it, the quartet split into two groups, trying to outflank the away team. Upon landing against the tarmac, the leader launched itself through the air again. This time, it would land right on top of the Maverick crew. Chris did not plan to let it get that far. Firing his phaser without a second thought, the amber beam of energy struck the creature dead center and tore it apart. A phaser set for kill should have disintegrated the xenomorph, but whatever it used for skin was too formidable for such a tidy demise. Instead of vaporizing, it exploded, spraying its acidic blood in all directions. With a sinking feeling, Chris realized killing these things in close proximity would be extremely dangerous. The acid ate into the ground as soon as the creature exploded. The tar beneath its remains dissolved before the away team's eyes, warning them what it would do to their skin.
Behind you!
Ezra shouted at Collins as one pair of aliens reached them. Collins swung around gracefully, like a dancer doing a pirouette. Her drawn phaser fired before the alien could lunge. Like the others, it met its end in the same gruesome manner, and Ezra dispatched the second alien approaching her flank. Noxious fumes of burning asphalt filled the air while ragged holes appeared where the acid ate away the paving. Angel was firing away with the same intensity, ensuring the remaining two aliens did not reach her or her captain as they fought side by side. Chris swung around and saw when running up the open hatch of the dropship when an ugly thought occurred to him.
Vin, not so fast.
He was too late. Vin staggered back when a dark shape with an unmistakable elongated head with razor-sharp teeth, claws, and a spindly tail leaped towards the Vulcan. Both tumbled down the ramp and somewhere through the rain, Chris heard Alex cry in horror.
Vin!
Alex dropped Bishop's remains and immediately went for her phaser but could not fire. Vin and the alien were a tangled mess of limbs, tail, and body parts. Without a clear shot, she couldn't be sure she wouldn't hit Vin or, worse yet, prevent him from being sprayed with acid if she struck the alien. Vin was beyond hearing anything at the moment. Alien saliva splattered against Vin's skin as Vin struggled to keep it from tearing him apart. In frenzied indignation, razor-sharp claws continued to flay while its skeletal tail lashed at him. If Vin was not Vulcan, he might not have been able to fight off the powerful creature. Alex screamed his name as she rushed in to help, attempting to dislodge the alien from the top of him when its tail lashed out like a whip and struck her hard across the body. Distracted, Vin dropped his guard and felt claws dig into his side.
Shit!
He felt blood running down his flesh, soaking his uniform even more as if the rain had not done it enough. He could feel the alien's breath on him, see the triumph in its bared fangs, and suddenly, Vin got very mad. Unaware of where the rage originated, Vin put it to good use. Ignoring the pain in his flank, Vin snapped his fist around the alien's thin neck. Using the animal's frenzied movements as momentum, he rolled on top of it and smashed his fist into what would have been the space between the alien's eyes if it possessed any visual senses. The blow disorientated the creature, and Vin continued pounding, reminding himself he could not break skin no matter how much he wanted to make this thing bleed. The xenomorph was not as restrained. It fought like a hellion, its powerful talons digging into his flesh, but the pain further enraged Vin by tapping into a part of himself seldom visited. Amid their combat, the wall between them diminished, stripping Vin of the civilization that separated them. The meld occurred before Vin even knew what was happening. Vulcans could read the thoughts of other creatures simply by making physical contact. It was why they cultivated such strict mental disciplines to keep themselves from being overwhelmed by the thoughts and emotions of others. Vin had only just learned how to fortify his mind against such incursions. As he fought this xenomorph for his life, he could feel their connection and sensed its violent mind. There was no conscience, just instinct. Driving wild instinct burning with the intensity of 1,000 black stars. This creature did not think. It did not ponder its place in the scheme of things. It was driven by one singular compulsion for which it would do anything, kill anyone, and use anything to accomplish. Nothing else mattered. Nothing could replace the feverish, all-consuming desire that dictated this alien being's entire existence. The need to breed.
Vin, get away from it.
Chris's order snapped Vin out of the haze that his mind slipped into. For an instant, he almost forgot where he was. Vin felt gripped with an overwhelming sense of rage and brutal desire he knew was not his own but the alien's. When Chris's voice returned him to reality, the lingering effects of the meld remained. The creature seemed equally puzzled, faltering enough in its frenzied attack to let Alex drag Vin to safety. Its savage aggression returned with a harsh screech a split second before Ezra fired his phaser and destroyed it. Still, the effects of the meld persisted, and for a second, Vin thought he might faint. Alex rushed to him and examined the wounds on his side and the deep cuts across his arms and torso. His uniform had protected him some, but not enough to prevent the fabric from becoming soaked with blood.
God, you're hurt.
We've got to keep moving. Vin, are you okay?
I'm fine.
Wint nodded, his head clearing as he answered the captain. The pain cleared his mind, but Wint knew as well as Chris he had to pull himself together fast. There were too many xenomorphs converging on them to squander precious time. The away team was closing in on the dropship, trying to stay ahead of the aliens. Wint had to get to the cockpit and fire up the engines if any of them were to leave this place alive. Vin, Ezra suddenly spoke out. The chief glanced over his shoulder at the prison behind them.
How long is it going to take you to lift off?
3 minutes.
Wint shouted, racing up the ramp. This time, he was a little more cautious of stowaways. A strange noise became audible through the teeming rain, growing in intensity. At first, the landing party thought it might be the rain, but now that they paid attention, they realized it was nothing like that at all. It was the snarls from a swarm of xenomorphs rising in tempo. They came into sight, no longer hindered by the effects of their long hibernation. Appearing on top of the buildings surrounding the tarmac, they were a sheer wall of black quickly encircling the dropship. They continued to snarl as they advanced, moving forward cautiously to avoid the range of their prey's terrible weapons. They were about to be hit by an onslaught of aliens.
Vin, we don't have that much time.
He was right. The aliens charged. They swept across the facility like a black tide, and the only sensible course left to the away team was the one order Chris never thought he'd give.
Run!
Alex had already scrambled up the ramp carrying the android Bishop. Chris could not bring himself to order her to leave the synthetic behind. Ezra told Collins to get on board the ship to search for any stowaways. Once she'd gone, Ezra's eyes met Chris, and without uttering a word, they both knew these creatures would tear through the hull of the dropship before it ever got off the ground.
Captain.
Ezra looked at him with resignation because they both knew what must be done.
I'll do it.
Chris volunteered before Ezra did the same.
If it wasn't for me, none of you would be here.
I don't understand, sir.
Angel stared at both men in puzzlement, wondering why the two senior officers were not coming on board the dropship.
Absolutely not, sir.
Ezra countered immediately, refusing to entertain the notion of letting his captain fall on his own sword to save their lives.
I will not let you sacrifice yourself. If anyone undertakes this suicide mission, it should be me.
Angel suddenly understood what they were debating. The captain couldn't sacrifice himself. He was Chris Larrabee. If the captain died, then none of them would leave here alive. A surge of courage surfaced inside the young ensign as she watched the two men prepare for the inevitable. Could she be that brave? When Christy died, she fled like a coward. Where had been the honor of that? The chief had been good to her. He had accepted her, a rookie, into his ranks when more experienced officers would give their eye teeth for an assignment on board the Maverick. The last few months on the Maverick were the best in her life, and she did not want it to end, but she couldn't stomach the thought of either man sacrificing themselves. The captain had great things to do and people who counted on him. Just like the chief, she had no family, and her life was her job as a security officer. Security officers weren't supposed to live long, and this was all her fault to begin with. She woke those things up. They were asleep, unaware of the away team until she broke protocol and searched for Christy in the hive without confirmation he was even there. Christy died because of her. Angel would not let the captain and Commander Standish die too. Taking a deep breath, she quietly turned her phaser over and set it on overload. The blast would ensure the dropship got off the ground. Angel descended the ramp, past the two men, toward the swarm that was closing in on them fast.
Ensign, what are you doing?
Chris demanded.
You need to get into the ship, sir!
Angel shouted, but inside she felt poised and calm. When Chris heard the low hum of a phaser set to overload, it dawned on him what she intended.
No, you don't.
Chris, no!
Ezra grabbed the captain before Chris Larrabee went after that poor child. Seeing their quarry come out to meet them, the aliens hastened their pace and were now converging on the young woman like a pack of wolves on a lone sheep.
Ensign, you get back here!
Chris shouted impotently, anguished as he saw her take the place that should have been his. The aliens swept over Angel until her uniform disappeared in a wave of black gleaming bodies, and Chris continued screaming her name, even as Ezra dragged him up the ramp. In seconds, nothing was left of the young ensign from Texas, whose appointment to Ezra's security staff he approved because he read her academy files and learned she liked books, the kind his father used to collect, bound in leather and age.
Captain, she's gone.
Ezra's voice cut through his ears as he forced Chris into the dropship, hiding his own sorrow at the loss of one of his youngest and brightest. The pain he felt was just as acute as Chris's, even more so because he'd worked with the young woman and knew she liked pictures of puppy dogs and was not just another uniform to him. Angel was something to him too. It wasn't just the captain's life she tried to save, it was also his. For this, Ezra was determined not to let her sacrifice be in vain by dying here and now. Collins pulled the hatch close as soon as Chris and Ezra were through. Tears ran down her cheeks as she secured the lock, having witnessed Angel's sacrifice from the hatch. She wiped the moisture away quickly because the present situation did not allow her to grieve. The interior of the dropship rumbled, with the engines coming to life to spirit them away from this nightmarish world. Beyond the hull, a powerful explosion rocked the ship's walls, followed by the screech of aliens dying from the fireball of an overloaded phaser, courtesy of Ensign Angel. Chris broke free from Ezra after regaining his composure. Guilt and grief could wait until he delivered what remained of his crew from the danger he so irresponsibly placed them. Hurrying past the two remaining security officers, Chris headed for the cockpit. Something scurried above his head as he made his way down the passage, drawing his phaser as the alien landed in front of him. Chris almost fired until he remembered if he did that, the creature's acidic blood would eat through the bulkhead and cause God only knew what damage. The dropship would be in the same predicament that caused the Sulaco to send Ripley and her companions to the EEV. Only there would be no EEV for them to escape. The alien crossed the space between them quickly, and Chris turned to run when the dropship lifted off the ground. The sudden jolt made Chris lose his footing and drop the phaser as the alien prepared to leap.
Captain!
Collins exclaimed as she arrived on the scene and saw her commander about to be torn to pieces by the alien stowaway. She reacted on instinct without thinking.
Don't shoot it!
Chris tried to warn, but it was too late. The dropship was already airborne when the beam of amber struck the creature in mid-thorax. Its body exploded, spraying acid in all directions. Chris barely got out of the way as the noxious liquid ate through the metal floor and filled the narrow passageway with smoke. The dropship continued to climb. Chris could see through the small window they were still soaring through the thick, cumulus clouds. He prayed the acid did not eat through any vital systems, and perhaps it would be all right. The ship dipped sharply, flinging both of them against the walls.
What the hell just happened?
Wynn demanded through his comm badge.
I just lost altitude control.
Ezra struggled up the passageway, and his expression after seeing the corridor filled with smoke and the hole in the middle of the steel floor told Chris he required no explanations. The dropship rocked once again, driving them to their knees.
I'm sorry, sir.
Collins said frantically.
It was going to kill you.
There was nothing Chris could say to her to lessen the degree of what Collins had done, but Chris knew she faced an impossible choice, one he would have made himself if he were the one with the phaser.
You did what was necessary. Then,
Chris tapped his comm badge.
We had an alien in here.
I guessed as much. Alex, see if you can stabilize that booster.
Chris heard him bark at the science officer in the background.
Can we maintain altitude?
Chris asked, although he could tell by the gradual dip of the dropship they were losing their ability to stay airborne.
I'm sorry, Chris.
Gwyn answered after what seemed to be an interminably long pause.
I don't know what killing that thing did to the ship, but we don't have the power to break orbit. We're going down.
Julia Pemberton peered past the edge of the armory door and stared cautiously at the passageway leading back to the hangar. Her palms moistened around the bulky weapon she was carrying, hoping she understood its operation correctly or her attempt to reach Fury 361 would be brief. Julia had not seen the alien since escaping its clutches in the runabout and dreaded facing the thing again, but Ellen Ripley's briefing told her the alien would not be far. The creature's bizarre biology demanded it propagate, and she was the only viable candidate at the moment. Julia had no intention of ending up like poor Lieutenant Atwater and planned to find the alien first. Her inability to contact the rest of the away team had given rise to some rather disturbing thoughts. The away team believed it was impossible for there to be an alien on the Sulaco, and yet here it was. Was it possible they made the same error in judgment about Fiorina? Julia thought the loss of communications with the landing party was because of Fiorina's strange atmospheric conditions. What if there was a more sinister reason for their silence? She might well be their only hope of escaping the planet alive. Thus, Julia simply had to fix the runabout and get to Fiorina 361. With this thought in mind, the chief engineer of the Maverick emerged from the armory, where she found a suitable weapon to replace the phaser she lost in the runabout. Although she found the gun cumbersome, she could not help thinking it greatly affected her morale. According to the manifest, the weapon was an M41 AAA 10mm pulse rifle with an over and under 30mm pump action grenade launcher. It was, in its day, state-of-the-art combat weaponry, seldom jamming, operating underwater or in a vacuum, and had no difficulty putting a sizable hole in steel plates. She hoped it did the same to aliens, who tended to spill acid when attacked. The gun was light, considering its large size, and Julia ensured she carried ample ammunition. While she had every intention of killing the alien if it got in her way, Julia had no desire to go hunting for it. If Ellen Ripley's tapes told her one thing, the alien was more than a match for a human. No matter how well armed she was, Julia was not confident enough to seek a confrontation with the thing unless she had to. She was more than willing to leave the alien with the run of the Sulaco while she repaired the runabout and retrieved the others from Fiorina. Stepping into the long corridor, Julia held the tricorder with one hand while keeping a tight grip on the pulse rifle with the other. She configured the tricorder to detect non-carbon-based life forms, not about to experience a repeat of the encounter in the runabout when it came out of nowhere and surprised her. Despite its savagery, Julia didn't think it was mindless. Its last attack was too fortuitous to be a mere coincidence. Was the alien compelled to act because it felt she was about to escape? Whatever its reasoning, Julia was getting out of this alive. As much as she admired Ellen Ripley, Julia Pemberton would not die like her.